But anyway, the bank's managers realize that this is not legitimate money. It won't do any harm. Dagon ultimately accepted the counsel of his advisors and did not order the burning of the bank. In general, however, that was the approach Sharon sought. A Mossad chief with a dagger between his teeth, as the premier told some of his aides. This did not mean, however, that he was eager to engage in a large-scale confrontation with the enemy. On the contrary, Dagon continued to argue that Israel should do everything to avoid a general military conflict with all of the states in the region, a conflict that would be impossible to win comprehensively. "It's the job of the Israeli defense establishment," Dagon used to lecture his new subordinates at the Mossad, "to do whatever it can to put off the next war for as long as possible, using covert means to strike at the enemy in a focused manner." Dagon took over the Mossad in September 2002. Shortly afterward, Sharon put him in charge of covert efforts to stymie Iran's nuclear program. Since the late 1990s, Iran had poured huge resources into its plan to acquire a nuclear weapon capability as rapidly as possible, buying equipment and expertise wherever it could. Both men saw a nuclear Iran as an existential danger to Israel. Dagon was told that he would receive whatever he wanted, money, personnel, endless resources, as long as he stopped the Ayatollahs from building an atomic bomb. He took it all and got down to work. Sharon was right to appoint him, Weissglass said. Meir arrived and began to work wonders. Dagon moved into his new office in the Mossad's main building and hung a picture of his grandfather, kneeling, staring in terror at the German troops around him, minutes before he was murdered. "Look at this photograph," Dagon would say to Mossad operatives before sending them off on missions. "I'm here. We, the men and women of the Mossad, are here to make sure it doesn't happen again." Dagon decided to dismantle the Mossad and reassemble it in a way that suited him. First, he sharply focused the Mossad's intelligence-gathering objective. Information was not to be collected for its own sake, cataloged and filed into an impotent library. Dagon wanted intelligence that could be directly put to use against the enemy. He wanted information that led quickly to preemptive and preventive operations, to sabotage, ambushes, targeted killings, and assassinations. The Mossad, under the new director, would be a warrior agency. "I told Arik, Sharon, that in my opinion, a deep change had to be made in the organization," Dagon said. "But you have to decide," I warned him, "whether you're ready to pay the price. Journalists will climb all over me and you and the Mossad. It won't be easy. Are you ready to pay the price?" He said that he was. Arik knew how to back someone up. Dagon frequently met in private with Sharon to get approval for covert operations. A former senior Mossad officer described the mood. Those were days of hysteria. Dagon would arrive early in the morning, and until nightfall he never stopped yelling at everyone that they weren't delivering the goods and that they were worthless. In Dagon's view, it was particularly important to straighten out the personnel in the Junction Division, which was in charge of recruiting and operating agents. This was the real heart of the Mossad, in his eyes. Underlying every operation, however you put it together, there is human. Junction's core personnel were collection officers, katza, case officers who recruited and ran the agents. They were sophisticated professionals, skilled in manipulation. According to Dagon, however, the collection officers also manipulated the Mossad itself. Dagon described the Junction Division he encountered upon assuming his position as a complete system of falsehood, which deceives itself and feeds itself lies in order to convince itself and the entire Mossad of its success. For years they did whatever they wanted. They recruit a guy who serves tea in some office near a nuclear facility and say they have someone inside the Iranian atom project. They needed to be grabbed by the collar and given a boot in the ass. Dagon changed Junction's procedures and demanded that all agents undergo a polygraph test in order to prove that they were reliable sources. Junction's collection officers strongly protested subjecting their agents to polygraph testing. "It will express lack of trust. They'll be insulted and won't want to work with us again." The director harshly dismissed these objections. "Are you an idiot?" he asked one of them. "The man betrays his country, everything that is dear to him. You think that he won't be willing to undergo a polygraph in exchange for money?" DeGan said that the resistance to the polygraph was, in effect, an attempt by Junction personnel to avoid exposing their bluff, because they had recruited unreliable agents. He made an effort to meet each of the Mossad's hundreds of case officers throughout the world on a frequent basis. The agent handler, who had never seen the Mossad director, suddenly sees him every 3 months, and he takes an interest in him not only on the theoretical level, but also in his operations, and asks him where he succeeded and why he failed. This severely hampered the ability of the man's bosses to later pull the wool over my eyes. Once DeGan had put the Mossad on an effective war footing, he also narrowed its mission. He declared that the agency would have only two broad targets. One was any hostile country attempting to attain a nuclear weapon, and Iran's nuclear project in particular. Importation of equipment and raw materials would be disrupted, stalled, and stopped. Facilities already in operation would be seriously sabotaged, and nuclear scientists would be harassed, co-opted, and, if necessary, killed. The second target was the radical front. There were no plans for an all-out war with Iran or Syria, but the Mossad could break the supply lines that funneled weapons to Hezbollah and Hamas and the PIJ. It could also go after individual terrorists, and it could take out the radical front's senior figures, even if they were Syrian generals. Under orders from Sharon, Amman chief Ze'evi Farkash agreed to let his military intelligence operation cooperate fully with the Mossad, creating a joint intelligence pool in which all intelligence could be shared, an enormous expansion of the Mossad's practical resources. To coordinate this vast inter-organizational effort and to head up the Mossad's hundreds of operations, DeGan appointed Tamir Pardo, the commander of the agency's operational unit, Rainbow. Formerly an officer in Sayeret Matkal, he had stood next to Yonatan Netanyahu when he was hit by a bullet during the Entebbe hostage operation. Pardo was a courageous operations man with strategic vision and an irrepressible drive. DeGan named him his deputy. In May 2003, in front of DeGan and the senior command forum of the Mossad, Pardo presented a top-secret plan, the product of an intensive four-month effort for stopping the Iranian nuclear project. The starting assumption is that a technologically advanced state with a wealth of resources like Iran, which seeks to attain an atomic bomb, will succeed in doing so at the end of the day, Pardo began. In other words, an immediate halt to the project can only be the result of a change of mind or a change in the identity of the political echelon in Iran. Some sighs and mumbles were heard in the room, but Pardo continued, "In this situation, Israel has three options. One, to conquer Iran. The second, to bring about a change in the regime in Iran. The third, to convince the current political echelon that the price they'll pay to continue the nuclear project is greater than what they can gain by stopping it." Since the first and second options were unrealistic, only the third option remained: to take overt and covert action that would put so much pressure on the Ayatollahs that they would decide to simply give up. In the meantime, until they reach the conclusion that it's not worth it for them, DeGan said in summary, we must employ a number of means to delay again and again their attainment of a bomb so that at the breaking point, they will not yet be armed with the weapon. DeGan had a bold idea for how this could be done: by asking for help from Israel's friends, even the ones who are ostensibly enemies. He knew that while most of the countries in the Middle East were publicly anti-Israel, in private they were more accommodating and practical. There is an intersection of interests, not a small one, between us and many of the Arab states, he said. The interests of most of those states, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf Emirates, Morocco, and so on, did not correspond with those of radical Shiite revolutionaries or their allies in Damascus, let alone their heavily armed proxy militias. Those Arab states mostly feared the thought of Iran with a nuclear weapon, maybe more so than Israel. From an operational standpoint, the intelligence services of those states had a number of advantages over the Mossad. Their operatives were Arabs who spoke the language perfectly. They maintained diplomatic relations with countries hostile to Israel, sometimes quite good relations, at least on the surface. And they could travel in those hostile countries relatively unimpeded. In many cases, they'd also already had spies in Syria, Iran, and Lebanon for many years due to internal Arab power struggles. Dagan ordered the Mossad to ramp up its secret liaisons with foreign intelligence bodies. Many of the signal achievements of Israeli intelligence during the following years, the ability to identify, monitor, and strike against terrorists in Lebanon and Syria, the intel about which Iranian embassies were dispatching terrorist cells throughout the world, the information about the Ayatollah's nuclear project, were a result of this cooperation. While these Arab countries condemned Israel at the United Nations, they were also collaborating with the Jewish state in the most secret of missions. Dagan's reforms led to sharp internal opposition and, later, to the resignation of many senior Mossad officials. The Mossad is a closed, tight-lipped organization fanatically committed to keeping its secrets. Any cooperation that might require divulging methods and sources to foreign agencies, especially Arab ones, was considered sacrilege. But to Dagan, this was all nonsense, merely an excuse for intellectual and operational decline. I thought they were wrong, that it was idiocy to oppose collaboration with other factors, Middle East intelligence agencies, who saw things the way we did, he said. The Mossad was obligated to mobilize whatever it could, any resource, any ally, in order to achieve its objectives. I told them to stop talking crap. Let's accumulate our own assets, blue and white, in order to do business with other intelligence agencies. I decided that anything that did not endanger ourselves or our sources could be traded, or otherwise no one would take us seriously. 300 people quit when I came to the Mossad. A massive exodus, he said. Incidentally, I'm glad that some of them left. In light of the demand for more and more operations, Dagan also abolished some of the Mossad's operational security protocols that had been in place for a long time, some of them for decades. Before he took over, if there weren't enough passports, credit cards, and secure means of communication for an operation, it was aborted, to stay on the safe side. A large number of operations were canceled due to these security protocols. Not under Dagan. He would call in the person in charge of the passports unit, who had warned that the documentation was insufficiently safe and would not stand up to scrutiny, said someone who attended many discussions in the Mossad chief's office, and tell him that if, by the next morning, there were not another 5 passports ready on his desk, he should have a letter of resignation there instead. Dagan confirmed the facts, but brushed away any of the concern. Nonsense. If you dig deep enough, you'll always get to the shit. It's all mices, Yiddish for tails, excuses for not taking action. Dagan believed in targeted killings as an important and necessary weapon, but only if used consistently and as part of a broad arsenal that included other measures, clandestine, diplomatic, and financial. Any single killing could be rationalized by the enemy as a unique, one-time misfortune, and even intermittent assassinations could be dismissed as products of circumstance, a fatal result for the unguarded and sloppy. In order for targeted killings to be strategically effective, they needed to be an ongoing threat. Sporadic eliminations are worth nothing, Dagan said. Eliminations of senior operational personnel, along with striking at the leadership level as a permanent and ongoing policy, are a very good thing. When I say leadership, I mean, of course, in the widest sense. Would I always choose to kill the number one? Not necessarily. I look for the supreme operative echelon, the one that really runs things, that has the most dominant influence on the ground. Amman and the Mossad drew up a list of candidates from the Radical Front for negative treatment. The problem was they were all in so-called target countries, where, as a rule, the Mossad did not carry out such missions. But Dagan decided to change this rule, too. When I came to the Mossad, there weren't real operational capabilities in the target countries, said Dagan. In order to rectify this, he first had the Mossad create documentation systems, passports, cover stories, etc., that would allow the operatives to withstand long interrogation if suspicions arose. Dagan also reversed the long-standing policy of conducting only blue and white assassinations, those involving only its own personnel. Dagan preferred to use proxies, based on his experience from the countless liquidations he was involved in during his military service in Gaza and Lebanon. I'm prepared to cry over the coffin of any such agent or proxy who dies and returns his soul to his maker. Believe me, I would shed real tears over him. But I also prefer to see them dead than my Israeli Jewish operatives dead. Dagan also pushed the Mossad to update its technology. He didn't personally understand much of that world, but he realized that it had become indispensable, and that the Mossad lagged far behind other countries' intelligence services and even other agencies in Israel. He appointed N, a senior operational officer who understood the needs of agents in the field, to head the technology division. The changes Dagan instituted soon began to show their effects. Dagan believed that the time had come for the agency to begin operations and argued that from now on, all targeted assassinations abroad should be under his command, and that they should be run by his deputy, Tamir Pardo. Amman opposed this plan, and a vociferous quarrel broke out between the Mossad and Amman's Aharon Ze'evi Farkash and Ronan Cohen. Ultimately, Sharon made the decision. Syria was transferred to Dagan's jurisdiction, and hits in Lebanon were to remain under Amman's authority. In parallel to this secret bureaucratic process, Israel identified a troubling change in the enemy's bureaucratic structure. The assassination of Sheikh Yassin in March 2004 effectively removed all of the restrictions he had placed on relations with Iran. The moment Yassin was taken out of the game, Hamas's center of gravity was transferred out of the Israeli-controlled territories to the leadership in Syria and Lebanon, and Khaled Mashal became the organization's strongman, said the Shin Bet's Yitzhak Ilan. Mashal instructed his men, led by Izz al-Din al-Sheikh Khalil, to inform the Iranians that Hamas was now ready to receive any and all assistance from them. The Iranians were pleased. With Hamas becoming a full member, the resistance front was now complete. Under Khalil's supervision, the Iranians began to send missile parts to the Gaza Strip in an effort to increase the range and lethality of the organization's arsenal. Instructors from the Revolutionary Guard came to Gaza as well. On September 26, 2004, Khalil got into his car next to his home in southern Damascus. Just as he sat down, his mobile phone rang. Ya Abu Rami, Hada Ramzi min Tabas. Abu Rami, this is Ramzi from Tabas, a village in the West Bank. Yes, said Khalil. How can I help you? The line went dead. A second later, the car blew up and Khalil was dead. Next on the hit list was Mahmoud al-Majzoub, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad's top man in Lebanon. On May 26, 2006, at 10:30 a.m., he left the PIJ's office in the port city of Sidon in southern Lebanon, accompanied by his brother Nidal, who served as his bodyguard. As Nidal opened the driver's door, a bomb concealed in the door was detonated via remote control by a lookout standing nearby, killing the two men. Of course I don't take responsibility for these events, Dagan said of this string of killings, following Israel's official policy of not claiming responsibility for targeted killings outside its borders. But as a concept, he added, if the state of Israel is dealing with a challenge like Hamas, the PIJ, and suicide terrorism, it's inconceivable that the Mossad wouldn't put its shoulder to the wheel. The hits against the personnel of Unit 1800, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas constituted a grave loss to those organizations, but they did not change the overall picture. The Radical Front continued to present a serious threat, and was still coordinating its actions against Israel. The Israeli public has always been particularly affected by abductions of IDF soldiers. Nasrallah, who well understood this particular sensitivity, ordered his men to conduct as many abduction operations as possible, and he advised his partners in the front to do the same. Some attempts failed. Those that succeeded caused great damage to Israeli morale. In October 2000, under Mughniyeh's orders, a special Hezbollah unit abducted three Israeli soldiers patrolling the Israel-Lebanon border. In order to secure the return of the abducted soldiers, Israel consented to a humiliating prisoner exchange deal with Hezbollah. The Islamic Jihad prisoners released in the deal resumed terrorist activity immediately upon their return to Gaza, launching a horrific campaign of suicide bombings. These freed prisoners managed to direct 8 suicide attacks, in which 39 civilians were killed, before the Shin Bet and the IDF were able to kill them or arrest them once again. On June 25, 2006, 7 Hamas fighters climbed out of a tunnel. They had spent long months digging it in secret, all the way from a well inside the Gaza Strip, under the border fence, and up to a nearby Israeli village. In a daring operation, they crept up behind an IDF encampment, killing 2 of the soldiers there, wounding others, and dragging 1 soldier, Gilad Shalit, on the road with them toward Gaza. They hung Shalit's flak jacket on the fence between Israel and Gaza, sending a message of defiance. The Shin Bet and the IDF were completely unable to locate the imprisoned Shalit. Though the Shin Bet and Amman were usually exceptionally effective at both intelligence gathering and operations within Gaza, the guidance Hamas received from Iranian intelligence proved itself. Throughout the entire 5 years of Shalit's captivity, Israel had no idea where he was being held. By the time of the raid, Hamas had already matured into a governing institution. 6 months earlier, with Iranian backing, the political wing had won the elections in the Palestinian Authority. Ismail Haniyeh, the elected prime minister, who had survived a number of Israeli attempts on his life, including the 2003 bombing of the conclave of the Hamas leadership, the Dream Team, traveled to Tehran, where he was promised $250 million in aid. "Iran is the Palestinians' strategic depth," he declared during that visit. "We will never recognize the Zionist regime. We will continue the jihad until Jerusalem is liberated." He returned to Gaza with $35 million in cash, packed into a number of large suitcases. Israel responded to the killing of its soldiers and the kidnapping of Shalit with a heavy bombardment on Gaza, killing more than 200 Palestinians. It also conducted raids in the West Bank, abducting a number of Hamas government ministers. But the organization did not blink. It demanded that Israel release 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the 1 Israeli soldier. 2 weeks after Shalit was captured, on July 12, the radical front turned up the heat. Hezbollah guerrillas abducted 2 soldiers patrolling Israel's northern border. For the Israelis, this was 1 attack too many, and the new prime minister, Ehud Olmert, the successor of Sharon who had suffered a stroke, told his associates that he was going to fuck Hezbollah once and for all. Arik Sharon had never hesitated to use force, but he had been skeptical of the IDF's capability to win such a war against Hezbollah's guerrillas. Olmert was sucked in by the assurances of the chief of staff, Lieutenant General Dan Halutz, who was certain that Hezbollah could be defeated from the air without endangering ground troops. Except for a donkey carrying a Katyusha here or there, he believed the Air Force's fighter bombers could cripple the organization's capacity to strike at Israel. This was a fatal error, which cost Israel dearly and ended Halutz's military career. Although the aerial bombardment of Hezbollah's positions did cause significant damage, its array of bunkers, launchers, and concealed communication systems held up. Israel knew very little about this array, which it called the Nature Preserves, set up under the supervision of Hassan al-Lakis on orders from Imad Mughniyeh, using advanced equipment obtained from Iran and Syria. Hezbollah rockets continued to rain down on northern Israel. Eventually, on July 29, the IDF launched a hesitant and ineffectual land invasion. It destroyed some of Hezbollah's positions, but the IDF also suffered heavy losses before shamefacedly withdrawing 2 weeks later. The entire campaign, known in Israel as the Second Lebanon War, was a humiliating defeat that achieved almost none of its aims. The most powerful military force in the Middle East had been beaten twice in 6 years by the same guerrilla army. It was something like the North Vietnamese army after the Tet Offensive, Dagan said. Although the offensive failed and they took some heavy blows, they won the war. After the ceasefire was signed, Nasrallah became the most popular leader in the Arab world, the only one in many years to have faced Israel in a military confrontation and won. Israel tried to compensate for its failure on the battlefield with attempts on the lives of Hezbollah leaders, primarily Nasrallah. If we had succeeded in killing Nasrallah, it would have changed the picture, said Halutz. We tried, but without success. Three times, specific intelligence information was obtained regarding Nasrallah's whereabouts. Once, a building was bombed shortly after he left it. Twice, the bombs actually hit his location, but failed to penetrate the thick layers of reinforced concrete above the underground bunkers where he was hiding. It's incredible what they built down there, said Halutz. You hit one spot, and all of a sudden you see the smoke coming out of some hole at the end of the street, and you realize that there's some tunnel down there that you never knew about. Other efforts to take out high-ranking Hezbollah officials ended the same way. On July 20, Israel tried to zero in on Lakhis by pinpointing his cell phone. An F-16 fired a missile into the apartment in Beirut where the phone was located, but it turned out that Lakhis had left it there and gone out. His son was killed. We did not approach this business, the assassinations, as prepared as we should have been, Halutz admitted. In June 2007, a year after killing four IDF soldiers and touching off another war, Hamas forces, angry that Abu Mazen's Fatah members still controlled Palestinian Authority institutions despite the Hamas election victory, massacred a large number of Fatah officials in Gaza and seized the strip by force, effectively setting up an independent Hamas state. The situation could not have been worse for Israel. From the north and south, it was surrounded by states and organizations with military power and enormous budgets, controlled by the Radical Front, while Israel itself was bruised and hesitant after the capture of its soldiers and the defeat in the 2006 war. A month after the takeover in Gaza, the Radical Front's senior commanders held a secret summit in Damascus to discuss future joint activity against the enemy. The atmosphere was festive. The front had succeeded in relaunching a campaign of suicide bombings within the State of Israel. An array of tens of thousands of rockets and missiles in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip had the entire territory of Israel covered. Hezbollah had defeated Israel's attempt to destroy it the previous summer. Hamas had won the elections in the Palestinian Authority and built its own state in Gaza. Iran and Syria, each on its own, were making significant progress toward completing production of a nuclear weapon. The situation, they all agreed, was the best the resistance axis could have hoped for. Israeli officials watched the conference from a distance and planned. Dagan knew this war would have to be fought in the shadows, replete with risks and without limits. Chapter 34. Killing Maurice. Ibrahim Othman sat down next to a pretty stranger at the bar of a Vienna hotel. He was a middle-aged man, balding and droopy-eyed, but the woman next to him seemed interested, at least in having a conversation. She spoke French. Othman spoke French, and loved Paris and dogs. Othman bought her a drink and told her about the poodles he raised at his home in Damascus. Othman was the director of the Syrian Atomic Energy Commission. The woman was a Mossad operative. The Israelis weren't exactly sure what kinds of secrets Othman held, but they knew he would be in Vienna in January 2007, and it was comparatively easy to run an operation there. They did not consider the operation to be an especially important one. It was being run concurrently with several that were deemed more significant. Nevertheless, while the female agent indulged Othman's stories of poodles at the bar, a team of rainbow operatives searched his room. A preliminary inspection didn't produce anything of value, and they began trying, without success, to open a heavy, locked case that Othman had left in the room. To do so without leaving any trace required a special effort, and in the meantime, a surveillance detail had noticed that Othman was showing signs of weariness and would soon be going back to his room. "I am going in. Give me the timing," whispered the commander, abandoning his lookout position and entering the room to take charge. Othman signed the check. "You have about 4 minutes," radioed one of the lookouts. The Syrian thanked his new friend, and the two arranged to speak in the morning and perhaps meet up. Othman began walking to the elevator. 2 minutes, radioed the lookout. Get out of there. In the room, the rainbow team had just opened the bag and begun copying the pictures inside it as quickly as possible, without paying attention to what they were. Othman was inside the elevator. 1 minute to contact, said the tense voice in the radio. By now, everything had been shot and the bag repacked and locked. The elevator's there. Get out now. Othman was now in the hallway, only 30 seconds away, almost within sight of his room. One member of the team was preparing to execute a diversionary trick by acting drunk and spilling a glass of whiskey on him. But with seconds to spare, the rest of the team exited the room and walked rapidly down the corridor in the opposite direction. "We're out. All's okay. Disengage," came the calm and confident voice of the commander. The material the Mossad team copied there that day was not immediately deciphered. It took some 2 weeks after the break-in at Othman's room in Vienna until someone looked at it. That was when they first saw the pictures of the reactor. Syria was trying to build a bomb. It was, in fact, making dramatic progress toward building a bomb, yet it had managed to keep the entire enterprise a complete secret. And this was one situation that could not be resolved by rubbing out a few key people. Drastic action of a different kind was called for. Strangely enough, Bashar al-Assad had enormous respect for Israeli intelligence, which was why he worked so hard to deceive it. He was convinced that every message in Syria transmitted by electromagnetic means, telephone, cell phone, fax, text, email, was being intercepted by Israeli intelligence. He truly believed that every time Mustafa called Mohammed, Moishele was listening in, an officer from Unit 8200 said, and that was not necessarily a drastic mistake. To minimize the risk, Assad instructed General Mohammed Suleiman, his liaison to the Radical Front, to set up a shadow army, one separate and independent from the rest of the Syrian defense establishment. Even the highest-ranking officials and officers, including the military chief of staff and the minister of defense, were kept ignorant. Suleiman ordered that all important communications be passed only on paper, in envelopes sealed with wax, by a network of motorcycle couriers. This retreat from the electronic age worked. Suleiman's organization remained totally invisible to Israeli intelligence for years. Suleiman's biggest secret was hidden away in the arid district of Deir al-Zor, inside a deep canyon a few miles from the banks of the Euphrates in northeastern Syria. Since 2001, he'd been overseeing the construction of a building to house a nuclear reactor that Syria had purchased from North Korea with Iranian funding. The reactor would enable the Syrians to produce plutonium for an atomic bomb, which, Assad believed, would give him strategic parity with Israel. Suleiman had spared no effort to conceal the site, but Othman was one of the few people Suleiman trusted. He knew about the reactor, and he'd left files concerning it in his bag. And now the Israelis knew too. When the Mossad got its hands on the material in January 2007, Mossad Director Dagan was in the midst of becoming the chief defense and strategy advisor to Ehud Olmert. When Olmert decided to go to war against Hezbollah in July 2006, Dagan fiercely opposed Chief of Staff Dan Hulutz's plan to defeat the Shiite militia through air attacks, and he told the cabinet, "I know Lebanon, and I know Hezbollah, and without boots on the ground on a large scale, it won't work." The more time went by and Dagan's concerns were validated, the more attentive Olmert became to his opinions. Dagan was someone who could see into the souls of others, and he was a talented PR man as well. He shared the juiciest tidbits of operations with Olmert, who was captivated by Dagan in his world of espionage and special ops. After losing his faith in the IDF and extensive all-out military campaigns, he gave more and more power to his spymaster to wage his war of shadows against the Radical Front. "I believed in Meir," said Olmert. "He needed my support in order to approve the crazy ideas that his agency came up with." The discovery of the reactor was yet another feather in Dagan's cap, especially since no other intelligence agency, including those in the United States, had been able to find it. But mostly it was a cause for serious concern. The news that the country's top enemy was at an advanced stage in a nuclear weapons program about which they knew absolutely nothing, swept through the length and breadth of the Israeli intelligence community instantaneously. "Meir came to me with this material," the pictures taken from Otman's room, recalled Ehud Olmert, "and it was like an earthquake. I realized that from now on, everything would be different." Shortly afterward, Olmert dispatched Dagan to brief U.S. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley and CIA Chief Michael Hayden. By this time, as he rode the elevator up to the 7th floor of CIA headquarters at Langley, he was already a familiar and welcome guest. Dagan got along famously with Hayden. "He was to the point, an intelligence officer in every bone of his body, and he listened to what I proposed." In turn, Hayden believed that Dagan was straightforward, plain-spoken, bluntly honest, unpretentious, sincere, and very knowledgeable. The two men established the closest levels of trust in history between the intelligence agencies of the two countries, initiating an era of deep cooperation. Hayden described the relationship between the agencies as complementary. "We're big, we're rich, technologically sophisticated, and we're global, while the Israelis are small, focused, culturally and linguistically smart, and relevant to the targets," by which he meant jihadist terrorism and attempts by Middle Eastern countries to develop weapons of mass destruction. Each time Dagan visited the CIA, he brought with him sensitive information and suggestions, some of them quite imaginative, for joint operations. But at that April meeting, not even the experienced Hayden anticipated the bombshell. Dagan sat down, opened his briefcase, and took out color copies of the pictures of the reactor at Deir al-Zor. For a long while, Dagan went over the material with Hayden, asking whether his expert saw eye to eye with the Israelis' analysis. Dagan was also well aware that, despite the Mossad's capabilities in Syria, his agency had almost no information about what was happening on the other end of the nuclear deal. So he asked Hayden to take the intel he had brought and plug it into the CIA's broader knowledge of North Korea. The next morning, Hayden went to the White House to meet with President George W. Bush. While he and the other participants were sitting and waiting for the president to arrive, Hayden leaned over to Vice President Dick Cheney, who had long opined that the Syrians were trying to get their hands on nuclear weapons, and whispered, "You were right, Mr. Vice President." Bush ended the meeting with two clear-cut but practically contradictory orders. Number one, be sure. Number two, this can't leak. Hayden went back to Langley, wondering how to confirm the Israeli information without spreading the word around. "To be sure, you want to get more people involved, but that increases the risks of spilling the secret." While trying to balance these two directives, the CIA and other U.S. agencies started an intensive, months-long effort to confirm and corroborate the information Israel provided us on the reactor, and to gather more details from our own sources and methods. The conclusions of the joint Pentagon-CIA-NSA team came in June, and they were just as worrying as the Israelis. "Our intelligence experts are confident," the team wrote, "that the facility is in fact a nuclear reactor of the same type North Korea built indigenously at its Yongbyon nuclear facility. We have good reason to believe this reactor was not intended for peaceful purposes." The United States had committed to Israel's security, and Olmert wanted that commitment honored. He wanted U.S. forces to destroy the reactor. Timing was an issue as well. Experts at Israel's nuclear facility in Dimona said that according to what they saw in the pictures, the Syrian plant was very close to completion. They estimated that it would be hot within half a year, and that if they waited until then to bomb it, it would cause radioactive pollution and an environmental disaster. Operationally, it was a relatively simple mission for the U.S. Air Force. A squadron of B-2 stealth bombers could have destroyed the installation without any special problems. But CIA Middle East experts reckoned that an American bombing mission in the region would be fraught with danger. "My analysts are very conservative," Hayden said to Dagan, in what he called one of the most candid conversations I ever had with him. "The Assad family," Hayden said, reminded him of the Corleone family in The Godfather. But when Sonny was rubbed out, the Don had the gifted Michael to replace him. When Basil Assad was killed in an accident, Hafez had to settle for Fredo Bashar, who was known in the CIA as a serial miscalculator. "Assad could not stand another embarrassment after the 2005 withdrawal from Lebanon," Hayden said. "Out of weakness, he would have to show his strength and retaliate with war." Dagan had the exact opposite opinion. "You had to look at it from Assad's point of view," he said. "On the one hand, he had always wanted to reach strategic equality with Israel and, therefore, to get his hands on nuclear weapons. On the other hand, Bashar al-Assad always preferred not to confront us directly. Furthermore, if he went to war after the bombing, this would expose the existence of the nuclear installation, that he had built an atomic facility in violation of his signature on the NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, which even the Russians, his allies, don't know about, and for sure would not be happy to know of. If we were to attack covertly and keep it totally under wraps, without publicizing it and embarrassing him, Assad would not do anything." The final decision was made in a meeting with the president that, due to the high degree of secrecy, was held not in the West Wing of the White House, but in the yellow oval room of the residential wing, so that the meeting would not even be listed on the public presidential appointments register. Only Vice President Cheney was in favor of an American attack, claiming that the United States should do it to send a strong message not only to Syria and North Korea, but also to Iran. Secretary of State Rice acknowledged that the reactor in Syria was an existential threat to Israel, but she did not think that the United States should get involved. Hayden made it clear that the reactor was in an advanced stage of construction, but Syria was still a long way away from getting a nuclear bomb. Already bogged down in two wars in Muslim countries, Bush concluded, "What Mike, Hayden, just told me is that this is not an imminent danger, and therefore we will not do this." Israel could rely only on itself. Nuclear weapons in Syrian hands would undoubtedly be an existential threat to Israel. But Amman analysts agreed with Hayden and warned Olmert that attacking Syria without direct prior provocation could lead to a strong military reaction by Assad. Dagan, on the other hand, recommended bombing the site immediately before the reactor was activated. "The state of Israel cannot tolerate a country with which it is at war having nuclear weapons," he said. Dagan had made a significant wager. If he was wrong, open warfare with Syria probably still would have ended in an Israeli victory, but it would cost thousands of lives. Yet despite the enormous risks, thanks to his charisma, self-confidence, and past successes, Dagan's opinion carried the day. At 3 a.m. on the morning of Thursday, September 6, scores of fighter planes took off from the Ramat David Air Force Base in northern Israel, 15 miles southeast of Haifa. it wheeled westward in the direction of the Mediterranean, and then southward. It was part of a routine base evacuation drill, familiar to the Arab intelligence services that monitored the Israeli Air Force. Nothing special. But this time the planners of the exercise were out to deliberately confuse those men watching the proceedings on radar screens in Damascus. Somewhere over the sea, a formation of 7 F-15I fighters broke away from the others and headed in the opposite direction, northward. The crews knew the exact location of the targets they had to destroy and the exact nature of those targets. The importance of their mission had been divulged to them by their commander just before takeoff. They flew very low, along the Mediterranean coast and then over Turkey, before entering Syrian airspace. At a range of 30 miles, they launched 22 missiles at the three sites within the nuclear complex. The Syrians were taken completely by surprise. Their air defense systems detected nothing until the missiles were already fired, leaving no time for the sites to be evacuated. A few anti-aircraft missiles were dispatched, but only after the planes were long gone. Shortly afterward, American and Israeli satellites hovering above Syria documented the total destruction of the site. Omert sent a secret message to Assad via Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, saying that if Assad acted with restraint, Israel would refrain from publicizing the attack. This would save Syria the embarrassment of being exposed as having acted in gross violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which it was a signatory. The world also wouldn't have to know that Syria had just gotten years' worth of expensive military research and technology blown up by the Jewish state, a situation that would almost necessitate some sort of face-saving retaliation. Keeping the whole thing quiet was better for all involved. The big winner in Operation Out of the Box, as it was codenamed, was Dagan, whose agency had produced the information that exposed the Syrian project and who, said CIA Director Hayden, turned out to be right, while my analysts turned out to be wrong. After the success of Out of the Box, Omert loosened the government's purse strings still further, granting the Mossad the biggest budgetary allocations it had ever received. One senior Mossad official said there wasn't a single activity that was postponed or canceled for financial reasons. The organization grew incredibly. Whatever we asked for, we got. Arik Sharon and Rabin were far more hesitant than I was in approving missions, said Olmert, with a satisfied smile, adding, I okayed 300 Mossad operations during my term as prime minister, and only one of them failed. And we kept the lid on that one, too. From the time he took over the Mossad, one of Dagan's top priorities was killing Imad Muhniya, the Hezbollah chief of staff. This goal was not unique to Dagan. Israeli intelligence and defense had been trying to kill Muhniya for almost 30 years. The enemy that had caused Israel the most damage operationally and politically in the preceding decades was Hezbollah, and Dagan thought that one man was the primary driving force responsible for its achievements. Muhniya, he said, is a combination of chief of staff and defense minister. Secretary General Nasrallah may be the political leader, but he is neither a military commander nor the man who does all the real deals with the Syrians and with the Iranians. Nasrallah, at the most, says yes. Muhniya was, in fact, an international fugitive, high on the most wanted lists of 42 countries. Dozens of nations had issued warrants for his arrest, and the FBI offered a $25 million reward for information leading to his capture. In Lebanon in the 1980s, Muhniya had killed hundreds of Americans in car bombings, and he'd kidnapped and tortured to death several high-ranking U.S. officials. The Americans remember, Dagan said. They appear to be liberals. In Israel, liberal also means forgiving and merciful. But they are far from that. The problem was no one could find him. Muhniya was a phantom. He was aware that Western intelligence agencies were investing immense resources to locate him, so he devoted equally immense effort to eluding capture, using fake documentation even inside Lebanon, limiting his contacts to only a small, close circle of family members and trusted associates, and employing a number of extreme measures to secure his communication. But in July 2004, after a senior Hezbollah commander, Khaleb Awali, was killed when his Mercedes exploded, the organization made a memorial film about him that was screened at internal gatherings. The Mossad got hold of a copy, and it was shown in December to a group of experts from Unit 8200 and the Mossad. During an all-night session, they scrutinized it in the hope of learning new details about the shadowy group. Late in the night, while everyone was sitting together in a room in Mossad headquarters, with their eyes glued to the screen, one of the 8200 officers yelled out, "That's him! That's Maurice!" Maurice was the code name for Muhniyeh. The picture on the screen showed Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah, in his brown cleric's robe and black turban, looking at an enormous tabletop computer monitor upon which a map was displayed. Opposite him stood a man, his face mostly concealed, but revealed for fractions of a second as he moved. Bearded, bespectacled, in camouflage uniform and a cap, pointing out different spots on the map for Nasrallah. This man was Imad Muhniyeh. Finally, they had at least some sort of lead. In the days that followed, various ideas were tossed around, including trying to trace the videographer in order to recruit him as an agent, or setting up a straw company for the supply of items like the tabletop computer their target was using, which could be booby-trapped and detonated when Muhniyeh was nearby. Dagan shot them all down. The Mossad wasn't ready yet. "Don't worry," he told the staff. "His day will come." The breakthrough came thanks to the persistence and inventiveness of Aharon Ze'evi Farkash, an Amman. The former commander of 8200 had spurred the development of more and more methods to deepen the SIGINT penetration of the enemy. Together, Ze'evi Farkash's Amman and Dagan's Mossad jointly devised a new operating system called HUGINT, a combination of HUMINT and SIGINT. In other words, a way of using the Mossad's agents in order to improve the capability of 8200 to intercept the enemy's messages, and vice versa. One of the developers of the HUGINT method was Yossi Cohen, the director of the Mossad at the time of this writing, who was known by his colleagues as the model, because of the care he takes with his grooming and appearance. In 2002, Cohen was appointed head of the Special Ops Department of Junction, the Mossad's agent recruitment division. Cohen was considered one of the most brilliant recruiters in the agency's history, one of the few who ever managed to break into Hezbollah and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and recruit Mossad agents from among their numbers. While undercover as various European businessmen, he was able to use his vast general knowledge and insights into human nature to enlist a huge number of agents, perfecting the Mossad's HUGINT methodology in the process. In recognition of these achievements, Cohen was awarded the Israel Security Prize, the country's highest decoration for defense-related achievements. In 2004, Dagan nominated Cohen to be chief of the Mossad's Iranian operations. Thanks to Cohen's agents and HUGINT, 8200 succeeded in cracking parts of the Iranian government communication systems, allowing Israel to penetrate deeper into the dense network of communications between commanders of the Radical Front. This generated more information about Muhniyeh, more clues, more eavesdropped computer communications and cell phone calls, more agents who had heard or seen something relevant. The top men of the Radical Front, the Israelis eventually learned, preferred to hold their meetings in Damascus where, under the protection of the Syrian secret services, they felt secure. After Hezbollah's victory in the 2006 war, Muhniyeh believed that Israel would greatly increase its efforts to kill him and Nasrallah. So he surrounded the Secretary General with an elite crew of bodyguards and persuaded him not to make public appearances or to appear live on television, and also to spend as much time as possible in Hezbollah's command bunker, underneath Beirut's Dahiya Quarter. As for himself, he relocated from Beirut to Damascus, both for security reasons — he felt safer in a city that was under the control of the Syrian intelligence services, which were considered tough and professional — and because much of his business was conducted in the Syrian capital. Although the protection of Suleiman's shadow army was very strong, Muhniya did not suddenly become any less cautious in Damascus, Dagan said. He allowed only a close circle of people to know that he had moved to Damascus, and even fewer knew where he lived, how he moved around, and what name was written in his fake passport. Nevertheless, Israel managed to get an agent inside that close circle around Suleiman, and it was in Damascus that we knew more about him than when he was in Beirut, Dagan recalled. Damascus was, however, the capital city of a target country and, along with Tehran, the most dangerous place for the Mossad to operate. It was clear that the numerous arrivals and departures of Mossad operatives in and out of the country, necessary for them to plan and prepare for an operation, would expose them to too much scrutiny, whatever their cover. And because of the extremely sensitive nature of the information, Dagan decided that this time he could not use Arab informants. So once again, Dagan decided to ignore a long-held, ironclad rule of the Mossad. He turned to another country to assist with an assassination. He invited himself to another meeting with Hayden. The CIA, however, is forbidden to carry out or support assassinations under Executive Order 12333. While both countries believed it was permissible to kill people, they had somewhat different legal perspectives. The United States would not normally participate in the execution of someone in a country with which America was not at war or involved in an armed conflict. Ultimately, the CIA legal advisors came up with a solution whereby it would be legal to strike Muhniya in Syria based on the principle of self-defense, since Muhniya was sending his men from Syria to Iraq to spur the Shiite militias to carry out terror attacks against American personnel. President Bush then granted Dagan's request for assistance, but only on the condition that it be kept a secret, that Muhniya alone would be killed, and that Americans would not be the ones to do the actual killing. Prime Minister Olmert himself guaranteed this to the president. Even years after the event, Hayden refused to say anything about the American involvement. The United States still had an active embassy in Damascus, and American businessmen could enter and exit Syria relatively freely. This enabled the CIA, with assistance from the NSA, to send in its own people and use its local agents for the mission. As one of the commanders of the operation put it, this was a gigantic, multi-force operation with crazy resources invested by both countries and, to the best of my knowledge, the most ever invested to kill a lone individual. With help provided by the Americans, Muhniya was eventually located. They discovered that he often met with his comrades from the Radical Front at various intelligence installations, office buildings heavily guarded by Syrian police officers and soldiers, and safe houses with undercover plainclothes guards. They also found out that Muhniya regularly visited three good-looking local women whom Suleiman had supplied for his rest and relaxation. Muhniya never took his bodyguards along on these visits to the women, which exposed him to surveillance and to his adversaries' operational activities in a place that wasn't under his control. They were a significant field security error, said one of the commanders of the operation. At the end, after so many years, even the most careful of men becomes full of confidence that nothing can happen to him. But an operation in any one of these places would make it very difficult for the Israelis to keep their promise to the Americans not to harm anyone else but Muhniya, not to mention the enormous risks that would have to be taken by the actual operatives. Mossad planners came up with a number of ideas, but all were ruled out. There was only one real possibility: to strike Muhniya on his way from one of the sites to another. There were still a number of serious difficulties, though. It was unclear how they would be able to follow him and eliminate him while he was riding or walking, since he was almost constantly accompanied by bodyguards and traveled on different routes and at different times, which the Mossad could not predict in advance. It was also unclear how the operators would be able to make their getaway before the airfields and ports were alerted and shut down. The deliberations dragged on for months as Dagan rejected plan after plan. Then, in November 2007, the head of the Mossad's technological division, N, came into Dagan's office with a proposal for an operation that would eliminate Mukhniyeh using a bomb detonated by remote control. This bomb would ostensibly kill only Mukhniyeh, with no collateral damage, and would also give the operatives on the ground enough time to escape the scene. Dagan said he was prepared to give the plan the go-ahead, though he believed that the chances of it succeeding were very slim. The basic assumption of En's plan was that it would be impossible to follow Mukhniyeh around Damascus, so instead, they would have to find a way to place the explosive device into something that was frequently physically close to him. A cell phone, like the one that killed Yahya, the engineer Ayash, in 1995, was always an option, but that was ruled out because Mukhniyeh kept changing them regularly. The one item he used consistently was his vehicle. At the time, a luxurious silver Mitsubishi Pajero SUV. The Mossad knew that both Mukhniyeh and his bodyguards frequently examined the inside and the bottom of the car to see if it had been tampered with. But there was one place they never checked. The spare tire cover clamped onto the back of the vehicle. With American aid, the components of a sophisticated explosive device were smuggled into Syria, as well as a tire cover identical to the one on Mukhniyeh's car. After months of preparations and meticulous surveillance, in early January 2008, Mossad operatives managed to get close to the parked SUV while Mukhniyeh was paying a nocturnal visit to one of his paramours. It took out the spare tire and replaced the cover with a new one, with the bomb inside. They also planted a number of miniature cameras and a transmitter so that Mossad operatives in Damascus could see what was happening just outside the car. The Mossad's explosives experts promised that if the bomb was detonated right when Mukhniyeh was about to enter the car, the explosion would kill him. But in order to be completely sure, they suggested that the bomb be detonated when the car was parked alongside other vehicles, so that the blast would bounce off them and cause considerably more damage. For 6 long weeks, the hit team followed Mukhniyeh, reporting to a special war room isolated from the rest of the Mossad, where only a select few were permitted to enter. Again and again, 32 times in total, the circumstances were almost right, but each time the operation was called off at the last second, either because Mukhniyeh was accompanied by someone else, or because there were other people nearby, or because he got in the car too quickly. The bomb was effective only if he was outside the car. On the morning of February 12, Mossad operatives watched Mukhniyeh approach the car with another man. "Hey, look, it's Soleimani," one of the operatives yelled out. Soleimani, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard strongman, was leaning on the Pajero, standing very close to Mukhniyeh. It was clear from watching them talk, there was no audio feed, that the two were very friendly with each other. Excitement about the opportunity to kill both men ran through the war room, but first they had to get approval. Dagan was at his home in Rosh Pina, mourning the death of his mother, who had died 2 days earlier. But I, the Mossad official commanding the operation, called Dagan, who in turn called Prime Minister Olmert. Olmert, however, refused to let them proceed. The explicit promise given to the President of the United States had been unequivocal: to kill Mukhniyeh and Mukhniyeh alone. That same day, at around 8:30 p.m., Mukhniyeh arrived at a safe house in the upscale Kafr Susa neighborhood of Damascus, just a few hundred yards from one of the most important headquarters of Syrian intelligence. He met with several aides of General Suleiman and two Hezbollah officers, and at about 10:45 left the meeting before it had ended. He exited the building, alone this time, and walked up to his Pajero in the parking lot. As he moved between his vehicle and another car parked alongside it, right before he opened the door, the order to execute was given. The bomb exploded. Imad Mukhniyeh, 30 years a phantom, was finally dead. The Syrians were in shock. A guerrilla fighter and tactical master, who for 3 decades had managed to evade the intelligence and military